You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Last year, in his best-selling Winter Journal, Paul Auster examined the trajectory of his life in terms of his physical body. Now he's followed it up by looking back at his moral and intellectual development from infancy through young adulthood in a memoir called Report from the Interior. Mr. Auster is the author of 16 novels, 9 works of nonfiction, 3 screenplays, books of poetry, essays, and collected correspondent. And this, his latest, is published by Henry Holt. I'm very pleased that it has brought him back to our show today. Hello.
Hi.
You'd initially assumed that it would be more challenging to write this memoir about your mind than the one you wrote that focused on your body. Did it turn out that way?
It was very difficult. And I think the hardest thing is the fact that one forgets so much. And I was only able to dredge up a certain amount of material. Crucial things, I think, things that stayed with me probably because they did feel crucial at the time I lived through them, but still so much gone. And that's why when I got to the third part of this book, it's in 4 parts. See, as I started writing the book, my first wife, Lydia Davis,
writer, the wonderful writer, translator.
You know, we haven't lived together for 35 years. We were kids when we were married, briefly. But it turned out that she was in the process of organizing her papers, and she found all the letters I had ever written to her when we were kids. 500 pages of letters.
And how old were you?
19, 20, 21, 22. And so that's when I decided I'm going to make another section of this book, because this material was so interesting to me, because what I discovered was a total stranger, a young man, a 19, 20-year-old boy that I had forgotten entirely.
Well, some people keep diaries or journals, and that's how they rediscover themselves. But you discovered yourself through these letters, and some reviewers have suggested that you were kind of brave to include
some of them are terribly written. Yeah, yes.
Well, not only that, but some of them don't always paint you in the best light.
No. Well, you know, honesty is the best policy if you're going to be writing.
That's part of writing a memoir, isn't it?
Yes.
You have to make a deal with yourself that you're going to show the good and the bad.
Yeah, I mean, there's no moral judgment attached to any of this, but no, it was just fascinating to rediscover that boy, and of course, I just picked excerpts. I kept nothing in about our love relationship. That seems to be of no interest to anybody at this point.
Well, it might be, but that would be a different book.
I was reading, what I was thinking, and the times were so intense. We're talking about 1966, the first letter, writing through 67, the year of the Newark riots where my family lived, the year of the Six-Day War, not to speak of 1968 and the cataclysms at Columbia where I was a student. So it's somehow a portrait of a lost young person living through that tumult.
Now, what about those other times? Because the first 2 parts are about you when you were a lot younger. And you do seem to be able to recall all sorts of things, including your feelings at the time. Were you just eating a lot of Madeleines?
Well, the first part is 100 pages, so it's not 3,000 pages. It's not a Proust's Dimensions. The second part is a description of 2 films that changed the way I thought about the world when I was young. The first one, The Incredible Shrinking Man, which I saw when I was 10 years old in 1957. And then I jump into early adolescence, 14 years old, and seeing a film that absolutely undid me. I Am a Fugitive from a Chain Gang.
Paul Muni's classic film.
1932, Mervyn LeRoy directed. One of the darkest, harshest films ever produced by Hollywood, I think.
And you include a detailed description of their plots.
Yes.
Were these films that, because neither of these films are like the films you wound up making when you ventured into filmmaking.
No, but you see, in the first instance, as I tried to communicate, it was a kind of philosophical or metaphysical jolt that film, The Incredible Shrinking Man, had on me. It absolutely changed the way I looked at the universe. And so,
in what way?
Well, I suddenly had a different perspective on things. You know, the large and the small, the infinitely big and the infinitely tiny. I'd never thought about this. And
but when we're kids, we are always looking up at the adults.
Yes.
And then...
and we're studying bugs, too, very carefully, and try to imagine what it would be like to be an ant, for example, or a bumblebee. But anyway, it was a jolt. And then the second film was, it came at just the moment when, I guess I could say, my social conscience had finally blossomed. And I was incredibly involved in following everything that was going on, for example, in the civil rights movement, which was, this is 1961 we're talking about, very intense times as well. And this film seemed to mirror the outrage I felt about the injustices of American society. And so it answered some deep need. And there was art talking about things that really mattered.
Isn't this your fourth memoir? The first was Invention of Solitude, which I guess is the book that introduced you to readers.
The first prose book, yes.
Then Hand to Mouth, Winter Journal. Now this one.
But we could also include The Red Notebook, which is a collection of true stories, most of which happened to me, some to people I knew and know. So five different approaches to autobiography, each one completely unorthodox, not following any of the rules that have been established. So I don't know. I keep coming at things from the oddest angles.
Well, most writers of fiction somehow include the autobiographical details in their books, even if their books are works of total fantasy.
Yes.
Have you tried hard to keep those things out? Is that why?
No, I've used things from my life in my novels, too. Often the tiniest things, sometimes somewhat large things, but that's different because the minute you put it in a novel, it's fiction, even if it really happened. One reads it differently.
Uh-huh. Well, then, of course, you also move it into a different direction.
Exactly.
From what happened in your real life.
Yeah. You know, the table I had when I was 20, if I put it in a novel, it's in a different room, it's in a different house. It's the same table, but it's different.
Well, since you write a lot, I'm surprised when you say that you were never able to keep a journal.
This is the problem. I didn't know who I was addressing. I just didn't. Was I writing to myself? Was I writing to somebody else? And then the thought was, why write down something that just happened to me? And I know what happened, not realizing that as the years went by, I'd forget.
For a very short time, in my 20s, I kept a diary. And when I discovered it years later, I was just horrified.
Well, it's shocking. It's just the way those letters were shocking to me.
No, I mean, I said, oh, my, was that me? Was I really thinking those kinds of things?
Yes.
So one of the ways you deal with this is writing this book in second person?
It started with the previous book, Winter Journal, which I felt was the only way to do that book, which was – it allowed me to enter into what I would call an intimate dialogue with myself and at the same time implicate the reader. And because, as I've said in different ways in each of the two books, I'm not terribly interested in myself. I don't think my story is a particularly unusual one. It's just that it's what I share with everybody else that's interesting. The things about our common humanity that I want to write about through the specific instances of my own experiences. But it's about sharing.
Well, what would have happened if you'd written it in first or third?
Well,
how much would it have changed everything?
First person would have been too too arrogant in a way. It would have been too isolating from the rest of the world. Third person would have been too distancing. And second person seemed just right, the intimate voice. It's highly unusual. I can't think of a single memoir or autobiographical book in the second person.
There are novels that have been
novels, written. But not nonfiction. But again, it seemed right, and I went with it.
My guest is Paul Auster, whose latest book is a memoir called A Report, or not a report, Report from the Interior. Well, in that first part, you talked about how difficult it is to remember things. But one of the things that jumped out to me was your description of a distinct memory of standing in a patch of sunlight in your house and realizing that you were 6 years old and feeling totally happy to be alive and to be six. Any idea of why that specific memory stayed with you so clearly for so many years?
I have no idea. I think it was is one of the few truly ecstatic moments of my life.
Now, why? You had a good childhood, didn't you?
No, not terribly good.
South Orange and
well, I mean,
nice
it was
home.
Physically comfortable, but I lived in a family with a broken marriage, parents who barely talked to each other, a crazy sister. No, it wasn't particularly enjoyable childhood. But that day, I think it was the dawning, I believe, of self-consciousness, the mature inner voice that stays with you for the rest of your life, awakens at around the age of five or six. It's, as I say in the book, it's the moment when you can think a thought and tell yourself, I am thinking a thought. And then you suddenly, as I say, until then I just was. And now I knew that I was.
And you also are realizing that other people have thoughts of their own that are not anything like your thought.
That's true, yeah.
You also remember loving the cartoons you watched in your family's on your family's black and white television, but not having an idea of how they were made.
No.
And then you were terribly disappointed when your mother took you and a friend to a taping of a cartoon
not
show?
Not a taping. It was the show itself, because I think it ran live then. So I was expecting Farmer Gray and Felix the Cat to be human-sized figures in three dimensions running around on a stage enacting their hijinks. And we got to the studio. Uncle Fred is there. And it was shocking, I must say, that he had makeup on his face. I'd never seen a man with makeup on his face before. And so we sit in the little peanut gallery. And on the floor in the studio is a television set. And we watch the cartoons on the television set, just the way I did at home. And I thought, well, where is the reality? What are these pictures? What are they connected to? Well, they're nothing. They're not connected to anything. And it was such a deception. It was one of the most disappointing things I'd ever experienced. I just misunderstood everything. And I still haven't gotten over it.
You remember being enthralled with Thomas Edison. Is that because you lived fairly close to
very close to
Menlo?
Yes. I was in South Orange. His lab was in West Orange, a neighboring town.
Where did I get Menlo Park?
Is that's the area in West Orange that where his lab was.
And then you realized that your barber was the same barber who'd cut his hair.
Rocco, right next to the Seton Hall campus. And I used to go there a lot because we all wore crew cuts back in those days. So we had frequent haircuts. And he had, right next to his mirror, a large portrait of Edison. And stuck into the frame was a note from Edison, to my dear friend Rocco. And then the corny Edison phrase, genius is 1% inspiration, 99% perspiration, Thomas A. Edison. So I used to think, wow, here's a man who used to cut the hair of the greatest scientific genius of all time, touching his head, and now he's touching my head. Well, maybe some thoughts from Edison's mind had gone into Rocco's fingers, which were now traveling back into my head.
Of course, later there comes disillusionment. You were extremely proud when your father told you he'd worked for Edison after high school. What had he done?
My father was very gifted in electronics. I don't know exactly. He was just one of the scores of young men working there. And then a few days after he was hired, he got booted out because he was Jewish. Edison didn't hire Jews, and that was the end of my father's career with Edison. And my hero turned out to have been an anti-Semite, which was another step, an important step in my education as a human being.
Your father hadn't told you right away.
No.
But that was not uncommon at the time, although in Edison's case, it comes as a bit of a surprise, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think so. But then when one thinks that he was Henry Ford's best friend, and we know about Henry Ford's political ideas, so maybe it's not so strange.
The book's final section consists of black and white reproductions of old photos of writers that you admired as a child, advertisements you saw, stills from the movies you describe. Did you include these images for younger readers who might not be familiar with them you and I are?
I wanted to recapitulate the book in images. So it's a march through the book again, but with the photographs. And I think there are no personal photographs, nothing of me or of my family, just the things I talk about in the earlier parts. Because I thought this part two about the films is about visual material, you see. And then part four is visual material. And it gives the book a kind of balance that somehow is satisfying in its structure. The fact that these pictures are there, I think they evoke so much. The polio poster that was all over the country in 1952 during the terrible polio epidemic, something I lived through. It was very scary. Everyone was in a kind of panic then. So these things evoke a certain time. These ancient days now.
On Masters of Sex, this series on Showtime, they did a thing about the day when there was this mock nuclear attack from the Soviet Union, and hospitals and schools and everyone had to adjust.
What year was that?
That was when you were very young, during the Eisenhower administration, late 50s, I guess. I was reminded that we were forced to crouch under our desk as though that was going to really help us in case of a nuclear explosion.
Yes, well, we had air raid drills too, but they would put us in the hallway. I never understood what good that was going to do if the school collapsed on us.
Well, not only that, if the radiation and the heat. Well, anyway, that's a whole other thing. These are things that the reason I mention it is we have to be reminded of them. They're there. They're powerful memories, and yet unless somebody reminds us, we don't think about them much.
No.
But they played a role in forming who we are.
Exactly. That's the point. And I thought somehow the minute I started writing the book, I was thinking about illustrating it with photographs. It was because I wanted exactly this kind of documentary evidence to support what I was writing about. But I don't like books that integrate pictures and text. Somehow it's distracting to me. But just by putting all the pictures in the back, you have a new experience. You can relive the book in a different way.
In the past, we've talked about you're not owning a cell phone or a computer. You're writing out your manuscripts in longhand and then typing them on an old-fashioned typewriter. Have you entered the 21st century yet?
No, I'm still with my old methods. I feel comfortable working that way, and I don't see any need to change. I have tried working on a computer. I just didn't like it very much.
It's still a keyboard.
Yeah, but it's
you don't have to hit that thing.
Too soft. It's too soft. It hurt my hands. By pounding on my old manual typewriter, I'm building up the muscles in my hands, and they don't hurt.
Paul Auster is the best-selling author of a number of many novels. How many did
16,
we say?
16, I think. Yeah.
Works of nonfiction. He's also made films and written a number of works of nonfiction. His latest book is a memoir called Report from the Interior. It's published by Henry Holt. Thank you so much for being on our show again.
Good to see you again, Leonard.